realize how insulting you're being? I mean, if I were your brother and you were my sister, you wouldn't be asking me all these questions.
If you were my brother, Eric wouldn't have been interested in you. He would have been interested in me. And then you'd be standing here asking the exact same questions I'm asking you, because then I would be the girl. And I'll tell you something else. I wouldn't even have gone out with him.
So you believe in the old double standard then, don't you?
No. No, I believe in a triple standard. One for girls, one for boys, and one for sisters.
I just wanted to let you know about my study group.
Oh, don't be a fuddy-duddy. I'll be your study buddy.
I'm about to embark on one of the great challenges of my scientific career.
This work right here is going to change history.
I think this is going to be our greatest mission.
I don't have time to study. I'll never get into Stanford.
I got big plans for you tonight. I got maps. I got charts. I got to see you through this because my credibility is on the line.
It's at this point that you'll want to start taking notes.
Welcome to the Sitcom Study, the podcast where we contemplate the TV shows we grew up with and search for the truth and wisdom within the tropes and cliches. And we are fully back in action. What is the trope we're talking about today, Amy?
Don't you date my sister!
Don't date my sister, the overprotective brother. Yeah, this is a big one. Lots of examples of this, both in sitcoms and in life. What's our lineup?
All right, so you know it's a good lineup when the most recent show that we're watching is 1991.
Yeah.
That's how dated this trope is. Okay, we're starting with Happy Days, which is a show from the 70s, but this episode is set in about 1957. Yep. So Happy Days, season 2, episode 8, Not With My Sister, You Don't. Bosom Buddies, also season 2, episode 17, Not With My Sister, You Pig. Family Ties, season 1, episode 2, wait for it, Not With My Sister, You Don't. And finally, Herman's Head, Season 1, Episode 25, Twisted Sister with a special guest star.
That's right. So we can say at least this is the most overlap in titles.
Oh, gosh.
We've had yes. several podcasts now where there have been two of the TV episodes
yes,
we covered with
three.
The same exact title. But yeah, to have three with essentially the same title is
the
impressive.
Bank heist one. They almost all of them had, like, wasn't it three? It was at least two, maybe three. It had like a Dog Day Afternoon.
Two of them had Dog Day Afternoon yeah. in the title.
Right.
And Blind Date, I remember, had at least two episodes that were simply called Blind Date.
Right.
So, yeah, look, this is definitely something that at least has its origins in life. And I would argue is kind of a perfect sitcom trope because it comes from real life emotions and situations, but definitely, as we'll see, can become a platform for all kinds of tomfoolery and buffoonery.
Absolutely.
But you and I in real life,
we're outsiders on this one.
Yeah, we are both older siblings.
Yep.
We both have younger brothers.
Yep.
So neither of us is a younger sister or has a younger sister.
And neither of us had, like, I don't have an older brother, right? Well, that's kind of what you just said. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So do you have any relationship to this trope? Is this something you have seen played out in your life?
Not that I can handily come, like, call to mind. What about you?
My girlfriend in college for several years was my best friend's cousin,
yes.
which is obviously a different situation inherently, but, you know, could potentially have similar pitfalls. But what I found with that was it was definitely a net positive in a way that's touched on briefly in one of our episodes. There's a point in Herman's Head where Jay talks about, wouldn't it be cool if we were in-laws? You know, wouldn't it
right.
be cool if I was your brother-in-law?
Yeah.
And this was back in college. Nobody was married to anybody or anything. But I definitely had that thing of, oh, once in a while in holidays and stuff, to have my pal here to hang out with when I'm dealing with my girlfriend's family. Like, that's cool. So, yeah, if anything, it was kind of fun from that point of view.
The way you said pal was so positive, and the way you said girlfriend's family was so derisive.
No, they're both good things, but they're even better when they're all the same.
It's like all of that bias is like baked into us, isn't it?
But yeah, so not really the same thing, but that's the only thing I can think of. But look, as we'll get into, yeah, this is something that is a very real phenomenon in psychology and to different extents is either appropriate or a little queasy or completely misogynist and fucked up.
Yeah, so. And it is. It's one of those weird ones that, like, I'm always of multiple minds about it. And even in these shows, I'm like, okay, I get that one.
To me, that one was done right.
Ugh.
It makes a difference if you're talking about a 12-year-old or a 20-year-old, but that we'll get into it. So let's start with Happy Days. This is, I think, just our second time covering Happy Days.
Yep,
the first time was Backdoor Pilots, where we met Laverne and Shirley.
Right.
So yeah, we love Happy Days. This is going to be weirdly a episode where Fonzie looms large, but not a lot of actual Fonzie in this episode.
Well,
this is a family thing.
Yeah, and this is a family thing. Okay, so we're still early days of Happy Days, right? This is season two, early season two. This is when the show focused much more on the family. In fact, this is the first season that Fonzie is, Henry Winkler is main cast. He was supporting cast. He was like guest appearing or whatever and featured in season one. Season two, he's main cast. He's in the opening credits.
He's like the opposite of Urkel and the same thing as
exactly,
Urkel.
Exactly. So he's kind of slowly, you know, taken over or whatever. Ha ha. But he is looming large in this. This is also one of the only episodes we'll ever see where Fonzie's riding his motorcycle. That very often is not the truth. He sits on it. He leans on it. They have a scene around it. But he actually rode it. It was like there was the scene where he rode it in the parking lot of Arnold's, which is a big deal because then we get the haha, his little nephew rides up on his 10 speed with the banana seat.
Let's talk about Arnold's for a second before we sink into the story, because I just have to say I love that Arnold's location. You know, we talk all the time about how I'm obsessed with is it on a stage? Is it in real life? Is there a real audience or whatever? Happy Days and all of these Gary Marshall shows, I think, are primarily shot, you know, multicam sitcom style on a stage in front of an audience, blah, blah, blah. You even have Tom Bosley saying Happy Days was filmed before
a live
studio
audience.
Oh,
but not in front of this one.
But Arnold's is so clearly a real world set with so much depth. Like you see behind them across the street, you see real cars parked in parking lots. You see other motorcycles lined up like half a mile away. And it not only does it add this verisimilitude, it reminds you, it links it to American Graffiti, which this is sort of like the unofficial TV adaptation of, because American Graffiti was all cars, drive-ins, out on the street, at the diner, whatever, like out in the world. It wasn't, you know, planted down in somebody's living room. And so when you start off the episodes like that and you just see the spaciousness of these real cars in this real parking lot.
And a real diner, because you can see the like the car hop women in the window working to get orders together, like all the way back at the back of the scene, even though the scene we're watching is by the cars, which are way, way in the front of the parking lot.
Yeah. So it just really brings me joy whenever they go there. Yeah. And it just totally ties together. It makes the whole thing feel real, even though most of it is on a stage.
So Gary Marshall and Happy Days, the first two seasons were not filmed in front of a live studio audience. The first two seasons were single camera shows, as you can tell in this one, right? Like there's a few scenes in the house that kind of feel like it, but none of them are set up with like the three camera, you know, multicam sitcom kind of feel. And no live studio audience. In fact, so this was the season that the ratings started plummeting, because over on CBS, this executive had programmed Maude and I think a Maude spinoff opposite Happy Days and was trying to get rid of the popularity of ABC. Well, at the end of the 1974 season, that same executive was hired away over at ABC to run television programming there and came up with an idea to save Happy Days because it was low in the ratings. And that's what was implemented in season three. And it was the multi-camera filmed in front of a live studio audience, total change. And that's what saved, in quotes, Happy Days, because then by season four, it was back in the top of the Nielsen ratings.
Do they still have these scenes out in the parking lot then? Is it a hybrid?
No, or they just... that's when the Arnolds that I remember kind of came in, where you've got, what's his name, Wax On, Wax Off as Arnold, right? And he's like...
Pat Morita.
Yeah, and they're always inside the diner. They're basically never outside anymore.
Wow, okay. Well, then, yeah, I guess that makes these first two seasons precious to me, because I do love this location. But anyway, like you said, while we're hanging out in the parking lot, we meet Spike, who is Fonzie's mini-me. In fact, Mike Myers must have stole this bit off of this episode. He's dressed just like Fonzie. He does the thing of like mimicking in real time his movements. Yes. Fonzie gives a thumbs up. The little guy gives a thumbs up.
And the entrance, right, on the little, you know, the motorcycle and then the banana seat bike, and then the same in Austin Powers, where you've got like the little scooter, the motorized scooter, and then Mini-Me comes in with his motorized scooter too.
Yeah, definitely. So Spike is Fonzie's nephew.
Yes.
And we've already established that...
This is the world before Chachi.
Yeah, I was just going to say, don't think it wasn't lost on me that when this episode begins, right, I want to just point out the efficiency of this storytelling. The very first shot is an establishing shot of the house, like most sitcoms, and you hear Richie's voice go, "Joni has a date." And so it's just like immediately, like 0 seconds in,
and we've got this plot,
up and running. And so, yeah, when I hear that she's going to be dating Fonzie's nephew, cousin, whatever, I'm like, oh, we're going to meet Chachi for the first time. I was, to be honest, skeptical because of the way the dates lined up. I thought this might be a little early for that, and it was.
Yeah.
So everyone's anticipating Joni's got a date with Spike.
Right.
And, you know, everyone's
I was noticing, man, it's really early in this series for Joni to have a date. Right?
Because I'm like, isn't Joni,
but they weren't at first, right? Like at first they were just trying, and I was like, man, she's got to be kind of young. Like, and then she comes downstairs and I'm like, I guess she could maybe be like 14 at this point, but I feel like she was in high school later on. Like, I don't think she's in high school yet. And then they're like, yeah, she's 12. She's going on her first date.
Yeah, this is junior high. And yeah, this is similar to one of the episodes we're not covering, but one of the first examples of this trope that comes to mind to me is The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. They had an episode totally, you know, same exact story with Will and Carlton spying on Ashley's first date.
Right.
And same thing, 12, 13, you know, starting to get to that age, but not really.
Yeah.
And so, what I was getting at before was that even though the overprotectiveness is definitely foolhardy, and that's where this episode is going to come down, it doesn't come across as sexist and weird and like total schmucks the way it does in some of the other ones because she's so young.
Well, and that's the thing. The whole family is supportive of her going on this first date. Everyone.
Well, Richie's a little concerned, isn't he?
I think they're just like, wait a minute, she's going on a date with who? Well, that's weird. Okay, whatever. But like, I think they're all, you know, Tom Bosley and Marion Ross are like, you need to talk to her. She's going on a date. I'm not responsible for talking to her, Marion. You're responsible for talking to her. You know, like, you need to go.
Marion, she specifically requests, this is the mom, she asks Tom Bosley, they're in bed together, and she says, you need to have, or like, somebody needs to have the talk with her.
Right. And he's like, that's not my responsibility. I talked to Richie. Notice he didn't mention Chuck, the older brother from season one.
Nobody mentions him.
But Chuck hasn't yet been written out. He appears in a few more episodes in this season.
He hasn't been written out. He's just been forgotten about.
But exactly. Because the dad is like, oh, I'm responsible for talking to Richie. Not, you know, doesn't say anything about Chuck.
That is funny. I was just noticing, and I guess this goes without saying, old timey gender roles on full display here. We glossed over the mom, Marion, makes a comment in the first scene. The man always pays. Right. That's goes without saying. Man always pays. And then we have
He's a good guy, he does. And then at the end, when they realize at the end of that scene, when they realized it was the way they met, I guess they didn't know it was Fonzie's nephew yet, but the way they met was the kid spilled a Coke on her. So Marion says to the dad, she's like, maybe we should give her a little money.
Yeah, yeah. And so you've got that, and then you have the gender-based sex talk thing,
right.
Which I guess holds true today. You would probably still do that most of the times. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you can, right? It's not always possible. I'll say that, like, the puberty talk at school is still, like, gender-fied, right? So, mm-hmm. like, our puberty talk for our fifth graders, the male teachers lead the male ones, and the girl teachers lead, like, the female teachers lead the girl ones, and so that's when that kind of talk happens. It's not birds and bees, though. It's like our changing bodies.
Oh, yeah, of course. We talked about that back in our first episode, that we didn't understand the metaphor about the birds and the bees. But yeah, so Marion tries to talk to Joni about sex. It's a pretty funny scene.
Oh, it is, yeah.
She's falling all over herself.
She's so uncomfortable. You know, I mean, like, we've seen a million times, like, that in and of itself is a trope, yeah, right? Like, the uncomfortableness in having the talk with your kid.
And the way the scene ends is a trope, too, even though it's funny. But you can see it coming a mile away when Joni's like, what do you mean? What do you mean what boys and girls do? I don't understand. And then after, like, 5 minutes of flailing around, she's like, oh, wait, was this the sex talk? And
yeah.
It's like, all things a moot.
And then the mom is, like, so relieved that she knows what sex is and has already talked to her friends about it that she just hugs her and is like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So we sort of have everything set up that Joni has this date fixed up with Spike, Fonzie's nephew. The family is, apprehensive to various degrees.
Right.
Richie seems the most apprehensive.
I would say Richie was kind of like, all right. I mean, I guess it's okay. Isn't she a little young? But then the family kind of talks him down. And then he finds out that it's Fonzie's nephew. So he comes home and he tells his family that. And that's when the dad is like, all right, you're going to double date with your date and babysit.
What the dad says, which I found very funny, when the doorbell rings, first, Marion tells Joni, she says, you go upstairs, don't look too eager, you know, which, again, that's a subtrope unto itself. The whole thing. Come downstairs for a few minutes.
Yeah, don't make him wait. You got to make him wait.
But I found it funny the way Tom Bosley turns to Richie and he says, will you stick around and help me meet Spike?
Yes.
Just that wording, I need help meeting him. And yeah, they let him in. And then what this is going to become is basically Richie's got a date of his own, this nice looking girl from school, and they're going to sort of chaperone, essentially. They're going to double date.
They're going to go see a movie together.
A Tony Randall werewolf movie.
Yes, it is not a real movie.
We don't know if it's real.
It's not. It's not a real movie. It was shot as a favor for Gary Marshall. Tony Randall and Gary Marshall know each other.
Sure.
And he's like, let's do this thing. It is the same set that was used in their haunted house episode in this same season.
That's funny. And yeah, this movie is nothing but kissing, right?
Yes.
It's like the four of them are watching this movie, which is like a little dialogue about I'm a werewolf, and then just kissing, lots of kissing. And then
Richie goes to get popcorn, and when he comes back, he goes into the row that he thought he was supposed to be in, but there's other people there, and then his date's gone, and the kids are gone, and then his date comes back, and he's like, where'd you go? And she was like, oh, I went to the bathroom, and he's like, where are the kids? And these other two people who are sitting in this row are like, oh, they left. They said they were going to go to Arnold's.
Yeah.
So then Richie's like, oh my God, I lost them and I'm supposed to be responsible for them, and runs off and drags
his date
with him.
He goes like, why didn't you go after them? And she says, well, I wanted to watch the movie. And he goes, but you already saw this movie twice. And she goes, but I've never seen the ending because both of the other times were at the drive-in.
Yes.
You know, so we get just more of this, this world in which you go to bang at the drive-in.
Well, or you go to neck at the drive-in, right? There's this, the madcap comedy of her hooking up with everyone from school is basically what we get over and over again in this episode.
You get the drive-in a lot in Happy Days, and then you also get these, like, Lover's Lane type places. And I wanted to just pause on this for a second because I'm genuinely curious. So the idea is, like, it's a staple of these 50s and 60s things. You have Lover's Lane, these places where if you're a teenager with your best gal, you just go park your car and go
park.
Do your stuff because, you don't have privacy in your own home or whatever. So I guess what I'm wondering is, do people still do this? Like, is this a thing, you think? Like, teenagers know of a certain place that you go? Like, the weird part to me, I'm sure people still fool around in their cars. The weird part to me is that there's this yeah. understood location that like all your pals are going to go to at once. And like, I'm going to be fooling around with you and my Chevy, and my friend's going to be messed around with his girlfriend and his, you know, Cadillac down the, you know, 20 feet away. Like the communal aspect of it.
You know, I don't know if that's still the case. Maybe in certain towns where there are, you know, limited places, but man, how interesting. I think, first of all, I think kids now just send nudes, right? Like they just like get on FaceTime and Snapchat or whatever. Like, who knows? I don't know. I'm old. That's what I sound like when I say that. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure people still make out in cars. I'm sure they still find places to do that. But man, how much safer is it when you know that the people in the car next door are not gonna rob you?
No, that's true. There's safety in numbers. Just to me, that would be strange to have this like sea of cars and know like, oh yeah, there's Freddy. He's probably
any stranger than having a house party when your parents are out of town and everybody's taking up different rooms and like making out in corners.
Yeah, I don't know. At least they're beds. I don't know. But anyway, that's where a lot of the second half of this story is going to take place. They're sort of farcically running around this lover's lane.
Right, because they go to Arnold's and they find out that they were only there briefly and now they've left. And then one of the waitresses is like, well, he's Fonzie's nephew, so he's probably, you know, idolizing Fonzie and wants to do whatever he wants to do. And so Richie's like, oh my God, he's taking my sister to Inspiration Point. And so then we get this great scene where you see all these cars and all these people making out in all these cars, and you get Richie Cunningham walking through them being like, Jody!
Yeah.
Jody!
That's probably what Jody! Made me think of all these questions. At some point in this, he dashes his date off on Potsy, because
right.
I wrote down Potsy is like Travolta in Pulp Fiction. He's like the guy that, hey, take care of her for a while, show her a good time.
Just watch my date for me, right? And then Potsy, of course, ends up taking the date to Inspiration Point, so they bump into him, and he's making out with Richie's date, and Richie is like, what the heck, guys? And like, isn't mad at all at the girl, is like, yeah, I get it, whatever, because he knew about the other times at the drive-in that weren't him, so he was fine. And so, yeah, Potsy was like, I'm sorry, Rich, but like, what else were we going to do?
Yeah, we find Fonzie also making out with a girl.
Yes.
One of his standard doesn't speak, you know, comes at attention when he snaps his fingers.
Yes.
One of his many prop girlfriends. And he puts out this APB, right? They're like, maybe we should split up and look for them. He's like, yeah, leave it to me. Yo, hey, everybody. And like, he just kind of makes this announcement like, Richie Cunningham's sister, where is she?
If anybody's seen her, honk. And then it's silent. So then Richie's like, okay, I guess that's it. We also skipped over the part where Ralph Mouth comes out from behind a tree because he didn't bring his car up to Inspiration Point, but he brought his date up there and they're making out behind a tree. So we never see her at all. She stays behind the tree. He tells her to look for poison ivy while he goes off to look for Joni and says, I'll be right back.
Yeah, lots of good hijinks at Lover's Lane. And yeah, we're in sort of full-on like mystery mode at this point / crisis mode. Like
right.
These kids
Richie's
are missing.
Really worried that he's going to get in major trouble because he was supposed to chaperone.
Yeah, and so basically, he goes home and false alarm.
He owns up to dad, and Tom Bosley's just like nodding and smiling in that way he does. And then he's like, Richie, why don't you come on into the kitchen? And we get our first of two Monopoly games in today's episode. So Joni and Spike are playing Monopoly. They got bored of the movie because it was all kissing. They went to Arnold's and I don't remember why they left there. And then Spike goes, well, what did you think I was going to do? Take her up to Inspiration Point on my 10 speed?
Yeah. And so this one, the moral is clearly like, they were just kids. They're innocent. You're the ones with the weird hang-ups. Leave them alone. You shouldn't have been so uptight about this in the first place. So again, like I said, this whole scenario plays differently because this is probably our youngest example. And yeah, this is, you know, and look, it's a depiction of an innocent time, and the whole thing has this sort of, you know, gentle, innocent tone to it. And so, yeah, it ends...
Gentle, innocent, except for Ralph Mouth is now also making out with...
It's horny and innocent at the same time. Yeah,
like
Happy Days
is
horny
all,
and innocent simultaneously. It's true. Richie and his dad have their sort of debriefing moment while they're kind of sitting there side by side, one of the last scenes.
Right.
And yeah, basically go like, we were pretty silly, right? You know, Howard Cunningham says something like, don't worry, don't follow her next time. I'll do it myself, hearty har har. And yeah, it's just supposed to be like I said, we were taking this thing too seriously. Aren't we silly for being overprotective? And yeah, that's kind of all we get from this one, right?
Yeah, that's it.
All right, let's see how this continues with Bosom Buddies.
Season 2, episode 17, Not With My Sister, You Pig.
Yep, so we talked about the Bosom Buddies back in our Mafia episode. We love these little rascals. They're always up to something. So, they're an advertising firm, right? That's their day job.
Yep.
So we talked last time about how, you know, you probably get all kinds of funny little commercial campaigns they're working on. This is no exception. They walk out into their little office thing to perform what they call a new wave commercial. But yes, as far as I'm concerned, they are Bebop and Rocksteady from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They come out head to toe dressed exactly like Bebop and Rocksteady.
Oh,
to the
so
point
do.
That, like, this is what that animation was based on. This got me thinking as I was watching there going, can we be this for Halloween? Nobody's going to recognize this episode of Bosom Buddies. Maybe we should just be Bebop and Rocksteady for next Halloween.
I think we should
Halloween.
Be Bebop That's and Rocksteady. I like that idea.
So yeah, let's table that. But yeah, this begins with a wild little demonstration that they're giving for their colleague or friend or whatever, who's the mom from Two and a Half Men.
Yes, Holland Taylor is their, she's not their silent partner, but she's their business partner in the, she ran the agency I think they used to work for. And then when they went out on their own, she was like, I'm not mad, but I want to cut. And
okay, so
she's
she,
there.
They run things by her, basically.
Right,
they,
right.
There's a running joke they, about how yes. she gives them advice.
And they run
like
away.
Her.
They run away from her advice. And there's all, like, you know, all the funniness.
Yes, they literally yell, we hate advice.
Which, we don't want to listen. Me. And they're like hiding in the back room and there's a little window and they're like, no, we can't hear you. No, no. And then someone comes in and it's this like mousy looking girl. And Holland Taylor's like, Kip, you need to come out here. It's your sister. And they're like, we don't believe you. And he's like, she's like, no, it's your sister, Vicky. And he's like, wait, Vicky? And so then we get the first of our weird little brother-sister tickle things that happens, one in this episode and then one later on in Herman's Head, where Tom Hanks is like, oh, I'm going to get you with the monkey. The monkey's coming for you. Yeah. And it's like this weird hand puppet thing he's doing where he's like trying to tickle her. And she's like, stop it, stop it. No, no, don't do it. No, no, no. And then he's like, okay. And she goes, I love that puppet. I love that monkey. And I'm like, this is fucking weird.
Yeah, it's weird. The larger trope is basically the brother infantilizing the younger sister. And we get the sense in Herman's Head, it's made explicit, but to me the trope is like in sitcom world you go like decades without seeing your family just
right.
like on a whim just
right.
like, oh hey mom, how have you been? Haven't seen you in 8 years, you know, like all these people are like
when
like,
you move to the big city from Ohio you never
yeah,
see your family again.
It is funny, like look, I've lived in this area, you know, adjacent to New York City my whole life, but I've worked with people who come from everywhere. They go home for Christmas, they go home for the summer once a while. Like it is this funny subtrope of like, oh hey sis, last time I saw you, you were playing with Barbie dolls at your 9th birthday.
Well, but part of that is like that's in their mind,
yes.
right? Like they're remembering their kid sister younger than they were the last time
right.
you saw them, because they it's like the last time they were actively involved in each other's lives. So like in this one, you know, he has seen her within the last couple of years or so, but she's now in college.
Okay, and, she's
and,
in college.
Or she's about to go to college. She's 18. She's about to graduate. And then in Herman's Head, same. He saw her 2 years ago, but now she's 19 and in college.
Okay. This girl, just to give you a little bit of a, to paint a picture, if you will, mullet, right? Basically like the sort of Liza but it's Minnelli. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's not like a 80s. Full mullet. It's more like Joan Jett, kind of like just a little flare on the bottom, but super
Joan
short
Jett's
on top.
A good reference. Dimples.
Yep.
And kind of like a Rachel McAdams face. Like when they show her
close up. Yeah, she's
very
got
pretty.
The doe eyes for sure. So she is, this actress is not much of an actress anymore, but she was a Groundlings kid in the LA scene. She does a lot. She's more of a producer, I think, now. But yeah, her name's Wendy Goldman in real life. But she, yeah, so she was like a Groundlings person. So I think that's where that whole like playing around, like this episode felt very loose. There were multiple times where I feel like there was no script written and it was like, let Tom Hanks play, let Peter Scolari play. Yeah. And I think she was able to kind of fit into that.
She talks like Frances McDormand in Fargo.
Yeah,
right?
She's got that extreme. But it's not quite Minnesotan, right? Because they're Ohioan. It's almost country. Like, it's this weird, like, she's doing sort of like a, it's almost like a hillbilly kind of accent. It's really strange.
Yeah, it reminded me of that. Like, oh, I'm just a super polite North Midwesterner, whatever it is. It was not the same vibe as Tom Hanks gives.
No, not at all. And they said they're from Ohio, which I was like, okay, I'm trying to place this accent. It isn't quite Fargo. And it wasn't quite like a, you know, like Fargo's almost like a Canadian with a little bit more. And then this is like hers. I'm telling you, it was almost like a hill. Like it was people from the hills. It was like where Ohio and West Virginia touch and the Appalachian Mountains are there. It was like just a touch of hillbilly.
All right. That's where she hails from,
I guess.
So the way this plays out is a little strange as they're sort of like breaking off for the day. Cause she even mentioned she got a hotel room for whatever reason. Yes. Tom Hanks doesn't invite her to stay with her.
Well, their whole setup is that they're two girls living in this like hotel for women.
I forgot about that because we don't get any of that stuff.
We only very briefly when Peter Scolari comes back from his night with the sister, he is in a wig and a dress and he immediately takes it off and hangs it by the coat rack. And
I truly forgot. Yeah. Like I sincerely forgot that there even was the drag aspect of it this time.
Right. Well, and so they're known as the brothers of these two sisters that live there. So if now another sister came,
it's just going to mess everything up. Right. So that explains why she doesn't stay with them.
So I guess we're just meant to assume that Tom Hanks has plans that night, even though he doesn't say that, right? Okay. But he says, Henry, I need you to take care of my sister tonight. Like, will you take her out and show her a good time? I don't, like, it's like there's too many men in this city that will prey on her. You need to show her a good time. So it's like he's busy, but he doesn't, we don't know that he doesn't say that. There's no indication later on that any of that happened. It just gloss over that. They're like, hey, you know, I'm Tom Hanks, you're my best friend, and you need to take care of my sister tonight, okay? And Henry's like, sure, why not? But there's that one moment at the very beginning where they hug for a little too long, and Kip's like, hey, cut this out.
That's true. But when they do go their separate ways, so I guess Kip, Tom Hanks, you know, spurs them on, but there is like, everything's okay. You know, Kip or Henry says like, hey, Vicky, why don't you come with me? Blah, blah, blah. Okay. No fuss, no muss. And then the next day, it starts what is like basically the rest of the episode, which is Tom Hanks just being obsessed with, did you touch my sister? What happened last night?
Right. Well, because Henry doesn't get home to the apartment until 6 a.m.
Yeah.
And so we've got Tom Hanks out on the balcony or the fire escape with binoculars. And then when Henry comes home, you see Kip like open the curtain and swing back in and take the binoculars down. And he's like, do you know what time it is?
So let's track this trope because we didn't get that in Happy Days. We sort of got the reverse of that. Nobody's waiting up. They're going around the town looking for them.
Right.
But in all of our subsequent ones, we're going to have this. We're going to have the
brother
waiting up.
Is waiting
up. Do you know
up?
What time it is, etc.
Like, do you know what time it is? It's 6 a.m. You know, blah, 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 blah. Where have you been? What happened? And Henry's just like, nothing. It's fine. fine, you know, don't worry about it. And then we just get this repetitive, like, did you touch my sister? What happened? Did you touch my sister? Did you touch my sister? Over and over and over again. He won't let it go. They go around and around in conversation over and over and over again. They finally end up back out on the fire escape where Kip leans on the railing and it falls off and the two guys plummet to the ground.
They argue each other off the fire escape, basically. Yeah, they're just so busy yelling at each other and like sort of coming to blows that
even Henry's just like nothing happened is this what you really want to ask?
He says we didn't do anything that I would be ashamed of or something, right? And Tom Hanks goes, are you ashamed of making love?
Yes.
You know, like, he's what Tom Hanks is butting up against, we should say, is that Henry, Peter Scolari, is not answering him.
Right.
Like, it's very clear. He's saying, what happened? And, you know, did you do this? Did you do that? And Peter Scolari is saying, don't worry about it. Just trust
nothing
me.
Nothing happened.
And we'll find out.
He is saying nothing happened.
Kind of. But he's saying, what Tom Hanks says is, you won't give me a straight answer, which is sort of true. Like, he's wording his answers in a way that you can tell there's something he doesn't want to say.
Right. He's not
and
lying.
We'll find out.
But he's saying, like, he's not going to tell him the story of the night, but he's saying, don't worry about the story of the night. It doesn't matter. Nothing happened.
Right. But he's, like, you could just tell he's not able to give him, like,
a full, complete, like, rendering of the evening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, and to Tom Hanks, that means you're not giving me a straight answer. There's something you're not telling me.
And he's like, but you don't worry about what I'm not telling you. You trust me. I'm your best friend. Let's move on. And they can't move on. So they fall off the fire escape. Then the next scene is they're in the hospital and they're right next to each other in the beds.
Full cast, slings, whatnot.
Tom Hanks has a broken arm that is, it's also like a broken shoulder because it's like a cast all the way up and around his shoulder. And then he's got the bar that like rests against his abdomen to hold the arm
fulcrum,
out.
I said the hypotenuse.
And then Peter Scolari's character has a broken leg. And so we get a little bit of laughs where they're goofing around because they're like, are you really high? I'm super high. And they're playing with the buttons and they're going up and down in the beds. And then it comes right back around to, did you touch my sister?
Yeah. And then all of the sort of tertiary characters start filing in.
Yes.
Right. Within a few minutes, you've got Kip's girlfriend is there.
A nurse.
Yeah. The lady who's the sister from Back to the Future who works with them, I guess.
Yeah. And she also, that's Amy. She also lives in the apartment building. And then you've got the super of the apartment building. So these three are the women that know the secret.
Right. So they, you know, when everyone is gathered in here, the line I wrote down was, Tom Hanks says, I'll tell you everything you need to know about this dime store Lothario, right?
Yes.
Everything comes out in the open, basically. Like, this is why we're mad at each other.
Right, because what we get is, like, this fantastic retelling of the fantasy in Kip's mind.
Everything but the pink border from Saved by the Bell.
Yes, of, like, what happened in his mind the night before and why Henry isn't being truthful with him. And so you got Henry in this, like, zoot suit with the pink
tie. Say Michael Jackson from Smooth Criminal or something.
Yes, it is kind of like that, but it's a hot pink instead of white.
Yes.
And there's this bed, this like random bed in there. Advertising agency, and he's lured the sister back there.
Well, and the way it's staged is very clever because it's almost like a play. Like, Tom Hanks is narrating it, and he's
in the
there
corner,
physically
in the bed,
in the space.
He's in his hospital bed in the corner, like narrating what's happening. It is very funny. Like, it's done in a funny way.
Yeah, it's also done in that way, almost like an old Goofy cartoon or something, where because you have Tom Hanks narrating, Peter Scolari is acting it out wordlessly. So
right.
It'll be like, then he seduces her. Then he, you know, and as Tom Hanks
and
is
he,
explaining
and he dances onto the bed behind her. And then Peter Scolari, like, dances over to the bed and falls because he trips on the bed.
It's like a silent movie or something.
Yeah, it's really fun.
He also says at one point, he's a regular bed astaire, right?
And then nobody laughed. And he was like, get it? Bed astaire. And he was like, never mind. Good joke. And just kept going.
Yeah. So basically, Tom Hanks lays out his scenario for how he imagines this took place. And yes, it's very funny. Of course, it's wrong. And so, you know, it falls upon Vicky to let Henry off the hook and say, no,
well,
you're
so
mad
what
at
I
him
was
for no reason.
Yeah, what I thought was being teed up was then you know, Henry was going to tell his side of the story when we come out of that dream sequence. But Vicky interrupts. The sister interrupts and she's like, no, 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 no. You need, like, this is all wrong. And you need to understand he's not telling you because he's protecting me.
Yeah, which I thought was fairly predictable. I did not anticipate exactly where this would go, which is, spoiler alert, she's a virgin. But I did anticipate she came onto him, basically. This is what I wasn't anticipating
that at all.
I would think that because Scolari was being cagey, the reason he was being cagey is because he didn't want to tell him, your sister, you know, there's things you don't know about your sister, and she's got a horny side, and she came on to me,
right,
and I had to turn her down, which is basically what happened, but with not a little bit of a different flavor.
Yeah, exactly. So the little sister, Vicky, has decided that before she goes away to college, just like American Pie, she wants to lose her virginity the summer before
which
she goes away to college.
I did not pick up that she was just starting college.
Yeah.
That makes it both more and less insane to me. It makes the fact that she is a virgin less insane. It makes the fact that she is coming on to Scolari and wants to be deflowered by him more insane.
Well, these guys are supposed to be like barely 25. So, you know, I think that's everybody looks older in this time frame.
And I guess you're supposed to understand that, as they mentioned, Scolari, he has some familiarity with her. I don't know if this is like a Chandler thing.
Since they were kids.
Right.
Like, so, he was talking to me, he was like, I've known you since you were eight. She was 8 years old. She was like, I've had a crush on you since I was eight.
Yes.
Because there was this incident they've mentioned a couple times in the treehouse with the dad's lather machine. So I guess they were like playing doctor or something. I don't know what a lather machine is.
I didn't catch the first reference, but then when she says something about the tree and the lather later on, I was like, what, did I hear that right?
Yeah, but that was from earlier. They had mentioned it earlier after the big long hug in the first scene. Kip was like, yeah, don't you remember the treehouse and the lather machine? And I was like, what is
but
that?
Here's the thing. The idea that you would have a crush on your older brother's best friend,
totally
get that.
Normal.
That makes a lot of sense. The idea that when you're this age, you would go visit them and request that he deflower her. To me, at this point in your life, you want that experience to be as far away from your nuclear family as possible.
You want a safe person. Like, there's an episode of Herman's Head in another season that we didn't watch, right? Where Louise, same thing. She's like, hey, Herman, I don't want a relationship with you, but I know you're safe. I know you'll take care of
me.
Like, I'm going to lose my virginity to you, right? And Vicky's whole thing in this is like, every girl plans it. Doesn't every girl plan it? And all the other women in the room are like, except for Amy, who is like, you know, she's the quote unquote fat one, right? She's like the one that's always the friend, never going to be like the girl or whatever.
She's the
frumpy
one with the Bronx accent.
Right. And so, but she is like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. I planned it and I plan it with you, Henry. Like, she clearly wants Henry. And she's like, I'll wait until your leg feels better.
That is funny. But yeah, I can't, like, it does make sense to me, kind of, and yet the scene when that flashback is eventually presented, when she says, no, this is how it really went, is very odd. And, you know, we're sort of dancing around it. To be clear, what it is the girl propositions Henry. She says, I am a virgin. I would like you to deflower me, please, before I go off to
college. Well, and I've always liked you. Like, yeah. I would like to, and she was kind of like, you know, I've always had a crush on you. It was sort of like, I would like to maybe have a relationship with you too, if you're interested, but I get if you aren't, but I want my first time to be with you because I've always imagined it that way. And that's not surprising to me. I totally get that. Like, I don't think she's wrong when she says girls plan it. I know a ton of girls who I went to high school with who decided who the guy was going to be and then set about trying to make that happen.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. What he says to her is interesting. Overall, I think his response is pretty appropriate and good.
Yeah.
But he goes, this has a lot of symbolism for you, and I can't be part of a symbolic act. Mm-hmm. That is his exact words. I can't be part of a symbolic act.
And I thought he was saying it that way because he was going to tell her that he does like her. It's just not the right time. Like, I heard that, and I'm like, huh, it would be really interesting if the show lasted for more than two seasons. Not that it was good enough. Let me be clear. But if it did, I could totally see, like, you know, two seasons from now, she's out of college because that's how time works in sitcoms, and they get together.
Sure.
100%. Because he was showing that he also kind of liked her.
Yeah.
Too.
And he goes on to say, like, well, you know, look, I've known you forever. I think about you as a sister, which is just kind of saying all the normal stuff.
Sure.
But it was just that phrase, I can't be part of a symbolic act, that seemed to me like a bizarre way to explain it.
Well, and that's why I was like, man, he's walking a fine line here, because he's not saying I don't want to have sex with you.
Yeah.
He's saying that, like, I don't want it to be this way, but he didn't go all that way to say all of that. But that's what I was hearing.
But then here's what he says that does bum me out. When the moment passes and she says, okay, whatever, they start to make light of it. And it's like, it's what always happens in these things. The tension breaks. Okay, yeah. We're okay. And then she says, I guess I'll have to wait for someone else. And he says, yeah, like your husband, maybe.
Yeah.
And that's where we get that cringy 80s moralizing where it's like, shut up, dude. Like, I'm sure that the other episodes of this sitcom have depicted you having extramarital dalliances.
Absolutely.
Why do we have to, like, add on that weird moralizing?
And she very nearly rolled her eyes at him, but I think they kind of cut away before she did.
Yeah.
Either that or she gave them multiple takes, one where she didn't roll her eyes, but you could see she looked like she was, like, about to say something smart back to him.
Yeah. And so, you know, everything sort of comes back to the present, and it's kind of like everything is forgiven. I feel like the tropes are in full effect now, right? We're building on what we already established with Happy Days, which is we're all a bunch of dummies. If you're overprotective about your little sister, you're just, you know, you're just wasting your time or being
a buffoon. You don't need
to
be so overprotective. Like, your sister is a woman who can take care of herself for the most part, right?
Yeah. But now we've got this sort of added, again, now the characters are older, so there's this added element of sexism, frankly, and it's treated sort of gently and funny, and it is. I don't think that Tom Hanks's character is like this horrible person, but the way that he's obsessively going, did you touch my sister? Did you touch my sister? And we're just supposed to sort of understand that as the catchphrase of, like, hey, you know how it is. If you're a guy and you got a little sister, you don't want anybody touching her.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's obsessive. Like, he won't let it go, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, we're sort of laying the seeds for what I think we're going to see persist in pretty much all of our stories. So let's move on to Family Ties.
Season 1, Episode 2. Not with my sister, you don't.
Yeah, so we've covered Family Ties a couple times now. This is a very high quality show. We love Family Ties.
Especially the first season.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. What I would say of the first season of Family Ties is it's very down to earth and sort of emotionally grounded and not super tropey. And yet this episode has basically, at minimum, three, like, major sitcom tropes all piled on top of each other to form this Frankenstein.
That's interesting that you would say that the first season isn't as tropey. I think what the first season does is that it writes the tropes well. Like, it puts them in a realistic situation. It allows them to play out to, like, an emotional, real, like, through line. Whereas I think in later seasons, while still good, we had the phenomenon of Michael J. Fox just being so damn charismatic and likable that they try to elevate him in every single show. And so it becomes more and more tropey.
Yeah.
And the plots are thinner.
It's not just him, though. The gambling episode we just watched
with the
mom.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Chewing the scenery.
In general, yeah, I think overall the quality of the writing and the storytelling does dip a little bit, at least get less consistent in the later ones. But yeah, this is right at the beginning. We are going to have a subplot about the dad being competitive with his friends that we don't even need to get into.
Well, this is one of these two, like, it is a half and half, right? The A and B story. storylines are equivalent. Like there's two A storylines. Basically, you've got the mom and dad are going out of town for their 20th anniversary, which they will celebrate again in, I think, the second season. So they celebrated 20th anniversary twice.
That gives us another trope.
Yeah.
Party when the parents are away.
That's right. Party when the parents are away. And the parents always go with this other couple that they met on their honeymoon. And Stephen, the dad, is very competitive with the guy who you may recognize as the coach from Teen Wolf.
Okay. I did not, but that's good to know. Yeah, that is going to be a very fun sitcom-y story where everything's a competition between the two of them. It writes itself. What we're here to talk about is Alex and Mallory, and this is where I feel like things really start to get prickly, you know, in terms of the gender politics of this trope. And this is, like we say every time, this is Michael J. Fox's superpower,
right,
is that he was able to make this character both odious and lovable, you know, and he is able to do what a lot of these sitcom buffoon dudes are meant to do, which is learn a lesson before our eyes, start out with some moral and or social intellectual flaw, you know, some sort of bad idea, some sort of bad way of thinking, and see the error of their ways. And with him, there's this specific political bent to it all the time. And
Michael, but it's interesting though, because we're episode two of season one. The writers haven't discovered that about him yet. This is still early days. So they didn't write this the way they would have written it in later seasons, where he's like, because girls just don't do that, and you're a girl, and you better sit down. But they still, like, they have him have the trope, which is, like you said, well established at this point, of whoa, 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 that guy is known for being a ladies man, and I don't want my sister to go out with a ladies man.
Yeah, we're going to get, in general, all of his sort of retrograde stuff. Alex has two sisters, right?
Yes.
Jennifer, God bless her.
She's 9 in this. Alex is in charge. Mallory is his younger sister. She's the middle sister, and she's only like 2 years behind him in school. So if he's a senior, she's a sophomore. But she is popular, right? And Alex is popular, but he's popular because he's super smart, class, you know, treasurer or whatever. I don't think he made it to president. There was an episode about that he didn't get to be president. But he's like class VP or class treasurer or something.
Yeah.
He's Mr. like man of the school. And she is not the like academic student, but she's very popular and pretty.
Yeah, they always read as peers to me. I know he's older, and so, you know, they have to be at least a year apart in school, but just, you know, she towers over him physically, and they always read to me as peers, you know,
right.
Like he doesn't come across
no,
to
and
me
they
as
play
older.
It as peers because they are just 2 years apart, but he is the older sibling, and he is trying to protect his younger sister, and there's like, you know, in the Pills episode, she was the one, like, we've got that great brother-sister relationship in the Hooked on Pills episode. We see the beginnings of that in this episode.
Sure.
Right? So, like, after this date that she goes on with the guy that he didn't want her to go on, she walks in the door and is like, oh my God, Alex, I gotta tell you about, and he cuts her off and won't let her tell him anything because of all of his baked-in misogyny that you've been referring to.
Yeah, this all started at the party, like we said. You know, Alex had this party. People were necking all over the place.
Jennifer's running around taking pictures. Yeah. Like, he's trying to chase her down and get the camera away.
Yeah, and we meet this guy, Eric, right?
Oh, is his name. Yes. Do you know who this guy is? Oh. Come on. This is the hunky Patrick Swayze type from Girls Just Want to Have Fun. He's the dancer. He's the main guy. And Girls Just Want to Have Fun opposite Sarah Jessica Parker. This is like 3 years before that, because I think this is 82 and that was 85. But yeah, that boy can dance. He can backflip. He's very good looking.
Alex introduces the two of them at the party because, like, they catch each other's eye, right? Mallory says, hello. And this Eric guy goes, that goes double for me. Right? So, Alex is just like, you know, he is suspicious about this from the get-go.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to introduce Mallory to this guy. Mallory's like, you know Eric, whatever his last name is? You've got to introduce me. And he's like, I don't know, Mal, that guy's kind of a creep. Like, he's always just wanting to get ladies in his car. And she's like, and then he comes over, they have that exchange. And then Mallory walks away to get him a soda. And he's like, he says to Alex, he's like, the only thing I got to figure out tonight is which one of these ladies I'm going to take back to the car. And, you know, if you hear that horn howl, it's on. You know,
he has a trademark car horn. That's kind of like a ayuga. Yeah. And Alex is watching him before his very eyes be hit on by these two girls, one of whom is Mallory, his sister.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's weird. It's unclear because this isn't a case of like, well, I'm such a, you know, lady killer. I'm such a cad and all of my friends are like that. So I wouldn't want you hanging out with somebody like me. Like Alex himself, you know, and this is only episode two, obviously, we haven't really dug into it, but Alex Keaton himself is a pretty low-key guy as ladies are concerned.
Yeah, but he definitely is trying. Like, he decides, yep, we can turn the lights off when that other girl starts paying attention to him and is like, come over here. Don't you want to leave the lights off? And he's like, okay, you know.
Well, but that's
only
after
a couple episodes. That's after Mallory leaves with the other guy.
That's after he stopped somebody from turning the lights off at first.
At first,
he's the sort of cop.
Because he's worried that his sisters are going to get caught up.
Yeah, so I guess I'm just saying that, like, he's definitely not a sort of super horny dude.
No,
like,
establishing in that scene, though, the double standard that he'll talk about later. There's a great scene later on when they start yelling, when Mallory and Alex start yelling at each other. And Mallory's like, that's a double standard. And he's like, no, it's a triple standard. I have one for me. I have one for women. And I have one for my sister.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, one for boys, one for girls, one for sisters. Yeah. And so all I'm saying is that it's hard to know exactly what Alex's stance on Eric and his whole style would be in the abstract.
He just wants to keep his sister away. He's like, whatever, like other girls, I don't care. He can go like, hey, I'm going to give him a high five. He can go off and do whatever he wants because I get it. Like, we're all trying to get with the ladies. But
I
don't want my sister.
What I'm saying is we get the overprotectiveness. We don't get the like dripping with hypocrisy type thing as much. Like we get a little bit of it because like you said, he's sort of ambivalent to Eric's antics if it's not about his sister. But yes, he's livid at Mallory. We get again the repeat of the, you know, pacing back and forth, waiting up.
Yes.
Waiting
Do you know
for
what time it is when she finally comes home?
Yes. And I love Mallory's reaction because she is just immediately like, no, start over, unacceptable.
Yeah,
like, this
try
is not
again.
Okay.
Because she had come in, she was like, oh my God, Alex, and he cuts her off. And she, like, it was so clear that she had a crazy night and she was about to tell him about her crazy night.
Yeah.
And he won't let her get it out. He's just like, do you know what time it is? Where have you been? How dare you go off with that guy? And she's like, you want to try that again? And he was like, okay, why aren't you home? And who do you think you are? And you're a girl and that guy's not safe. And she was like, okay, and just walks upstairs and ignores him.
Yeah, so we get the same sort of arc as what happened with Bosom Buddies, where like there's just this whole sort of like misunderstanding in the air, and he's like, you know, he doesn't know what happened. He's
right,
just
because
like,
he's being such a jerk about it. Yeah,
yeah, and so then when it finally sort of
and
all
Jennifer's
comes out,
the one who has to tell him. Jennifer's like, I saw it on Donahue.
Yes, definite subtrope of this time. The 80s and 90s loved that joke of a kid saying something sort of like emotional or profound and going, well, I saw it on Sally Jesse Raphael.
Right. So she's like, I saw it on Donahue. Communication is the key to any good relationship. And she was trying to talk to you and you cut her off. So you need to talk to her. And so then Mallory comes downstairs and he's like, Mallory, we need to talk. And she's like, you know, Jennifer, please tell him that I'm not speaking to him. And Jennifer's like, Alex, you have to try. Remember communication. And so he's like, come on, Mallory, we really do need to talk. And so then they start yelling at each other. And that's when the double standard line, no triple standard line happens. But they finally come around to that. You know, she's how dare you?
Back.
Yeah, she's like, how dare you? I can take care of myself. Nothing happened that I didn't want to happen. And who are you to say that, like, I, you know, tell me what I can do. And then the doorbell rings.
Yeah. And so Eric shows up. And so at first, Alex is like, well, this isn't good. Like, this guy is still around. And he says...
And he shows up with flowers.
Yeah. But he goes like, well, I wanted to give you a chance. I wanted to give you another chance. Obviously, you weren't thinking clearly last night.
Right.
So this is another one where, like, I don't know if I had this exactly mapped out in my mind, but I'm just like, well, clearly this is going to be that she, like, shot him down or something. This can't be a case like Bosom Buddies of, well, she came on to him, because that just wouldn't work with
this
story.
No, it didn't jive with his whole attitude. Absolutely. Right. Like, you can tell from right away, either, like, I thought, because I know that there is an episode where they deal with a sexual assault.
Sure.
In this season alone, there's an episode where a family friend gropes Mallory and kisses Mallory.
Oh, yeah.
And she has to tell her mom, and there's the dad has to go and talk to this, like, they call him Uncle Gary or something like that. And so then the dad has to go talk to this guy who's like their friend and be like, you're not allowed around my family anymore.
Definitely a very special episode.
Yeah, for sure. And so, and I know that they dealt with, like, sexual assault in some other way. So when we first watched this, a year or so ago, when we were starting to watch Family Ties, I was surprised at the way it went, because it could have gone two ways. Like, I was like, oh, it could have been that this is the one where she gets assaulted and then now they're dealing with that fallout, or it's going to be, like you said, she blows him off.
Yeah, it has to be, because if she got assaulted, that would vindicate Alex's whole deal. It would be like, he was right to be in her face and to be not letting her go.
And to be angry.
Yeah, the whole point is that she can take care of herself, and she... I don't know how clearly they explain it. He got handsy and she
got... So when she comes home the first time, her blouse is like half untucked. She's a little bit unkempt. And her hair, she had her hair tucked up and like half of it had fallen down on that same side where she, you know, where her shirt was untucked. And so she talked, like she says, and that's when the wrestling match began.
Right.
And so he, you know, he got a little more handsy than she wanted.
Yeah, to me says not taking no for an answer.
Exactly. She was like getting him away from her, and then she got away and came home.
Yeah.
Like, and so then he shows up with flowers, like, thought you want to have another chance to go on a date with me. And she was like, excuse you, get the hell out of here.
Yeah, exactly. So he's just sort of ejected from the premises. And so we're left with another sort of like, okay, let's take a breath and figure out what happened here. And the thing that I think doesn't totally sit well or age well is just that, like, Mallory, I think, is maybe one or two notches more appreciative and forgiving of Alex's overprotectiveness.
Right.
The idea that he's like that because he loves her, fine. Like,
and that is what she says. Like, she's like, I know that you're just looking out for me, but you need to recognize that I can take care of myself in a lot of these situations, and you need to listen to me and not, like, bulldoze me.
And just the end. Like, I feel like what the show doesn't totally absorb is, like, that thing you said about the triple standard is very, very dumb. And, like, you should really think about that. Because this one does get into in one of their arguments. She says, like, if this were me and you were the girl and I wouldn't be saying this to you. And he's like, well, if I were the girl, then that wouldn't make sense because you wouldn't be saying it to me or whatever. Like, their sort of logic thing just kind of falls in itself. But she is saying, like, yeah, this is sexist. Like, you know, this whole attitude you have is based on a messed up understanding of women. And the fact that that sort of transforms into, well, it's all because you love me. Again, I don't mind a little bit of that, because this is a real life thing and people are protective because they love each other, and that's fine. But I think if this were made now, the emphasis would be more on you need to get over these hangups and less on it's sweet that you want to chase away any boy that looks at me.
Yeah, I don't know, though, because I feel like still now, still today, oftentimes when you have, you know, men talking to other men, trying to be be like, hey, you know, come on. All like, you can't talk about women this way. They're mothers, they're sisters. Would you want your mother and sister or daughter talked about that way? So it is a, it's still feeding into that protective nature
But that has, in some circles, become a punchline.
Yeah.
Become a lame cliche, like, thoughts and prayers and stuff, because it
is some
dumb.
Circles, but not all circles.
Yeah, you're right. But yeah, I guess that's what I'm hoping is
I think that thought still reaches people. It still makes men pause in a way that is asking them to deal with sexism by leaning on other sexism.
Right. And look, if you want to be generous, you could say it's just asking you to personalize it. It's just asking you to think about people that you know from your own life, and that's fine. But yes, it has become a very lame cliche. And yeah, I guess all I'm saying is that I would hope that the modern equivalent of a show as smart as Family Ties would, like I said, change that emphasis.
I think you're right. They would talk about it in a different way, particularly a show like Family Ties, if we were doing it today.
All right. Now let's get on to some really enlightened thinking. Herman's Head.
Season 1, episode 25, Twisted Sister.
Yep, Herman's Head is another one, kind of like Charles in Charge, that I have a personal relationship with that is a little bit out of proportion with the general culture's relationship with. Last time we covered it, we talked about how we got really lucky and we had a good episode about Herman's fear of public speaking that really used his brain people.
Right.
Right. Just in case you don't know, Herman's Head is just like the Pixar movie Inside Out. It's what if you got to personify the different basic emotions inside your mind. So you have his lust, his compassion, his intellect, and his anxiety personified as these characters that they cut to inside his brain. And the rest of the show is basically just a workplace comedy about Herman. This one is going to be more like what we always kind of criticize Herman's Head for.
Yes.
His brain people are just
totally ancillary in this. And part of it is that they've got an amazing guest star, right? Like, this is starring Jennifer Aniston as Herman's 19-year-old sister.
Yes. This was very much in the time when Jennifer Aniston was knocking around every pilot season.
Guest starring in everything, had a new pilot or two every season.
Probably in Leprechaun around this time.
Yep.
Pre-Friends Jennifer Aniston. She's going to be Herman's sister who's coming to town. We have the little sort of anticipatory scene before she gets there where he's talking to Louise and Hetty, his co-workers. He's saying he's planning on taking her to a show and to see the Statue of Liberty. They're making jokes about how, oh, you want to show her the real New York experience, you should punch her in the face and spit in her eye.
Oh, yeah, hit her, knock her down, steal her purse, and give her the finger. Take her to Central Park. That was the joke. Yeah, he's preparing to do all that. This is a very Friends-heavy episode. We have Hetty, who is Carol, Ross's ex-wife, in Friends. We have Jennifer Aniston, who is Rachel, obviously in Friends, and Hank Azaria, who is Dr. What's-His-Face,
Phoebe's
boyfriend
interest.
That goes off to the Arctic to study penguins or polar bears or something.
And of course, Herman's Head, like we mentioned last time, it was on the Fox network the same exact time as The Simpsons was getting started. So it shares two main cast members. Yardley Smith plays Louise, Herman's co-worker, and Hank Azaria plays Jay, who's his buddy, who is very much your exemplar par excellence of the horny best friend. He is just like that total cliche through and through. You know, they literally wrote on the character breakdown horny best friend.
Yes. Right?
Like, there's nothing else to say.
That's who he is. And so Jennifer Aniston, Herman's sister, rocks in, and he has been talking about her like she's, you know, the last time he saw her, she was, you know, going to try out for cheerleading, and he's imagining her in his mind as this, like, 12-year-old girl.
She's being played by a child.
Right, as this 12-year-old girl, and so, you know, we're expecting to see somebody pretty young show up, and then someone, like, you know, happy and joyful, because that's what he's talking about, and in walks this, like, Gen X it's all black. I don't care. My name's not whatever anymore. It's like Astrid now.
If Janine Garofalo looked like Jennifer Aniston.
Right. Yes, exactly. She was just like, ugh. She's wearing all black, a beret. She's like, life is dead. Nothing is alive. Everything is awful.
Yes.
And so he's like, what happened? And so then he's like trying to figure this out. He's like, what happened to cheerleading? What happened to the boyfriend? You guys have been together since junior high school. She's like, oh, he's dead. And Herman's like, oh my God, what do you mean he's dead? And she's like, no, he's just dead to me. Like, we broke up. And we find out later that he, like, again, Herman was remembering this kid from middle school when really he's been traveling around following the Grateful Dead for the last 3 summers. And Jennifer Aniston says to Herman, like, hey, you know, I'm not the girl that you're remembering. Like, you went away to college when I was 12 years old. You've come back for bits and pieces, but it's been like 8 years or so.
Now, this is where they may have gotten off the hook in the other one, but this time they're specific about the fact that Herman hasn't seen her in years.
No, he says 2 years. He hasn't seen her in 2 years.
But even so, that is insane to me. And I mean, I don't know. I guess people go away for a long time, but they also say later in the episode that he went off to college when she was 12. So I guess you're supposed to understand he saw her a little bit
he's
now
seen
and
her,
then,
yes,
but
he's
he
seen
hasn't
her,
gotten to connect with her.
Exactly. And she's like, you haven't been a major part of my life for all this time. You are remembering me younger than I am, and younger than, in fact, I have been for a long time.
Right. Susie has changed her name to Astrid to protest the rainforest, right? Or the degradation of the rainforest.
Who was it, Jay, who was like, how's that going for you? Like,
Well, Jay's first taste of her is they take, you know, the work gang takes Astrid, Nee, Susie to their bar hangout.
Yes.
And then Jay, who doesn't work with them, he works at for the same company, catches up with them and he sits down and goes, who's the Amish babe?
Right.
Because she's dressed all in black. She's smoking cigarettes. She orders a vodka tonic.
Right. She wants a drink, which I guess was the drinking age 18 still?
Let's just stop for a second and just talk about the ages in general, because this is one, she shows up, my assumption is, they don't specify her age right away.
Not right away.
So my assumption is just, oh, she's a young woman, don't think much about it. Then at some point, they say that she's 19 years old. And then that kind of takes me aback. Because then I go like, well, I don't know. Now are we back to Joni and Chachi, where it's like maybe it is appropriate to be overprotective of her? For what it's worth, I did the research about the real life ages here. So this came out in 1992, right? Jennifer Aniston was born in 1969, so she was 23 at this time. Wow. Hank Azaria, who's going to be the one that she gets together with, was born in 1964, so he's 28 at this time. So we're looking at a 23 and a 28-year-old, which is how they read to me, which is why if
but
you're just
in the show,
it,
in the world of the show, right, we find out at some point in this season that Herman is 25. So he's 3 years out of college, and Louise is only a year out of college. She's like 22, 23, right?
And Jay reads, if anything,
and
is
Jay's
older,
right? So even though he and Herman are best friends, Jay is already a writer. He's a little bit ahead. So like he might be like 27.
So that's
say.
What I'm trying to say is that their real life ages and the way they come across intuitively seem fine to me. She does seem younger than him for sure,
yeah,
but
for
they're
sure.
both adults.
And she's played young. I mean, she's got her hair down in her face. She's still got the chubby cheeks.
Yeah,
like, this is Jennifer Aniston, like, before first season of Friends, where she's still young.
It's
very,
one of the
very
youngest,
young.
Yeah, you're ever going to see her in acting professionally. But I'm just saying that when the show reveals that she's 19.
Yes. By the way, they reveal that she's 19 when she's wearing Jay's shirt and only Jay's shirt.
Yeah.
In the hallway. And it's like, you know, that's a sexy look. And it's like, whoa. They're revealing she's, which again, like 19 for a certain period of time was an acceptable age to like, now I'm a woman. Now I go do these things. 19, I feel like now, I think people are like, you're still a kid.
Yeah, exactly. I guess what I'm saying is that watching it now and the way that the rest of the story is going to play out, it comes across as weirder as this unforced error where it's like, why didn't you just make her 22? Like, why this whole thing would just feel a little less strange if she wasn't so young.
Yeah. And I think I always struggle with this show because of the ages that they say that the characters are. Like, Herman does never, like, he never reads 25 to me. Yeah. Like, they, you know, Louise, she's like 30, but yeah, they say she's like 23. Yeah.
They're all 30. They yes. all look 30 to me. I was surprised to find out that Azaria was actually a little younger than that at this time. But yeah, so that's all I'm saying. To find out that she's 19, yeah, it's weird that they're serving her drinks, but it is the 90s. And yeah, the whole thing is just weirder than it has to be because of this age gap that is bigger in the fiction of the show than it even is in real life.
Right. And there, and that it, that isn't the big deal, right? The big deal is not that she's so young and you're so old. It's, you're a Lothario, that's my little sister, stay the heck away from her. And then we get the twist of Jay actually is like, whoa, hey, I like her. I don't like women.
Yeah.
I want to be with your sister. I want to date her. I want to, like, be with her.
Yeah. This is weird to me. So let's just slow down, make sure we're totally digesting everything that happens. They basically, they meet in that first bar scene
and then
kind of hit it off.
They, well, they argue right away. And then Louise is like, hey, Herman, come here. I got to ask you something. And then when they turn around to come back to the table, the two of them are gone. And then they spend the whole night together and then many days together, because the next scene we have is Herman in his apartment going, do you know what time it is, when she comes in?
Yep.
And
once
he's
again.
Yeah, and he's like, and she's like, no, and he goes, it's 12:30, and she was like, well, why'd you ask me? Which I thought was a funny joke. But it, then it's revealed that it's 5 days later, and she spent every single day of her week there with Jay. And Herman's like, what is going on? Why are you doing this? Why aren't we hanging out? Like, I know you're sad about your breakup. I tried making you cupcakes. And she's like, yeah, that's the problem. I tried coming to you with the things that are bothering me, but you're treating me like a kid. Jay's not treating me like a kid. I'm having a great time with him. And they get into this fight, and she's like, ugh, whatever. And she leaves, and she goes off to Jay's again.
Yeah. Now, I guess what I don't get about this, and no offense to Jennifer Aniston, who, you know, everyone knows why anyone would want to get together with her. She's a beautiful woman. But this character that Jay is like, you need to understand, Herman, like, this is the real thing for me. It just reminds me of...
I've never felt like this about anyone before.
Yeah, I just got done watching the 50 Shades of Grey movies, where you're supposed to understand...
I'm sorry.
This, like, rich man about town that could have, like, any woman in the world is just, like, stone cold obsessed
yes.
with
a
anesthesia.
19-year-old.
Yeah, with this young woman who's like, I'm gonna be late for class. What's a butt plug? She just has no, like, you're just like, what is it? Like, what is the appeal? You know?
I only like women who aren't taking classes and know what butt plugs are.
It is just the thing of, like, yeah, like, the show just does not convince me. Like, it doesn't even give you, like, anything, right?
No,
like, a scene
no.
of, like, what is the spark between Jay and...
It doesn't have to. It's a sitcom, and the spark is that they're, you know, they argued with each other, and she's smart, and she's hot, and he's an older dude who's successful. He's got that great apartment. Like, who
yeah,
cares?
Well, again, I know why she would be into him. And I can get why he would want to bang her. I don't get why he would be like, this is like the love of my life. This is.
I mean, first of all, Hank Azaria is nearly fleshed out in the limited 3 seasons that we have with him as like a Barney kind of character, where he got his heart broken. He acts this way because he's like trying to heal.
Yep.
And then the next time, so Aniston comes back in season 3, and we have it. There's an episode called like Jay is for Jealousy or whatever. And at that point, Jay and Louise are together. And remember, that's like the next time someone captures his heart. It's this, like, you know, lovely little innocent girl in Louise who has that, like, lovely little innocent girl thing, but also sees right through his shit. And I think that's what you have in Astrid,
yeah,
you know, as well. And because she's Herman's sister, he's like, nicer to her and like knows he can't just be like, oh, love him and leave him because he's Herman's best friend, right? Well, so there's all these things that are sort of acting against him to kind of, and there is this weird thing that happens, and I don't know if you've seen it in some of your friends, but I've seen it in some of my friends and men that I've dated who talk about when they dated someone way younger. It's like this weird thing that happens where they like project themselves as to being that age and what it was like to like fall madly in love and not be jaded. Sure. And all of that.
You
so
make me feel young.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. What makes this one different is that even though Eric from Family Ties was ostensibly friends with Michael J. Fox and Spike as Fonzie's nephew ever, this is the first time where the primary relationship, as we understand it, is Jay and Herman.
Yeah.
And it
bosom buddies, but there wasn't an actual relationship.
That's true. It comes to Herman sincerely asking Jay at one point, not just being like, did you touch my sister? Did you touch your sister? Saying like, please don't do this.
Right.
Like, as your friend, I would like us to continue to be friends and I would like you to not do this.
Right.
And that part to me, I have to say, did kind of ring true, especially like for younger people, I think. Like, I guess, to be honest, I think of it more as like dating your ex versus dating your sibling. But the thing of like when you're younger and your sexuality is such a big deal and so tied into your identity and things are, you're so emotional and everything. The idea that you would just be like, can you just not, can you just find somebody else and not complicate everything? Like that did ring true to me.
No, and they played that really well, like in that moment. And then Jay's response was, I wish you hadn't
done
that.
Well, so here's the thing. And this is not the comparison you might be expecting, but that ending is brilliant in the way that the ending of Hannibal, the sequel to Silence of the Lambs, is great.
Okay.
That movie ends with Julianne Moore, the new Clarice. She handcuffs herself to Anthony Hopkins, to Hannibal, so that he can't get away from her. And so they're like bound together. He hears the sirens coming, like the her backup is coming. And he goes, he basically says the same thing. I wish you hadn't done that. He goes, you know, this is going to hurt. And then cut to the next scene. It's later revealed he cut his own hand off because he loved her so much. So when he said this is going to hurt, he meant it was going to hurt himself.
Yeah.
And it's similar to when Jay goes, when Herman says it's either her or me. And Jay says, I really wish he hadn't said that, and just leaves silently. And you think it's like the kiss of death. And what he means is, I wish you hadn't said that, because I have to break up with her because I value your friendship so much.
Yeah. And so then we got Jennifer Aniston upset in Herman's apartment, and he, you know, Herman comes home and he's like, what's going on? And she's like, oh, Jay broke up with me. Like, this sucks. And so she finally gets through to Herman that he's not looking at her like the woman that she
is. He doesn't understand who she is. Yeah.
Right. And so that's when we get the scene in the brain where it's the guy who plays the lust, but he's not just the lust. He's like all things that are sort of like machismo-y.
Yes.
And he's skirt chasing.
Yes,
he's like, he loves to watch sports, and he's basically Tim the Toolman Taylor inside Herman's head. And so the rest of the people in the brain are like, hey, you know, she's right. We need to think about, you know, we need to think about her as more grown up, because she is. And that part of the brain is like, no, absolutely not. That's not who she is. And he like goes and pouts in a corner. And then the little girl sister that's been in the brain says to the other brain people, I got this, and walks over to him and is like, hey. And then they have a little conversation that kind of mirrors the conversation that just happened in real life.
Now, I'm just thinking how interesting it is that the way Herman's head, as the serious psychiatric study that it is, breaks down by having the lust, who, like we said, sort of represents essentially the toxic masculinity.
Right.
He's the one that's hung up on her being a little kid.
Yeah.
The compassion, the one that's supposed to be the source of all of his real emotions, all of his real empathy and all of that, has no problem with accepting her adulthood.
Right.
So it's sort of showing you that, yeah, it's not like what what they're saying in Family Ties.
God, was Herman's good for a second?
It's showing you that, when you want to beat up every guy that looks at your sister or yell at your sister for coming home late, that's not your love and compassion in your brain that's being activated. That's maybe not your lust per
se. It's not your intelligence. It's not your anxiety. It's the toxic masculinity that lives within you. Wow. Oh, man, Herman, look at you being deep and still sucking at the same time.
I did put that when they do have, the moment where they show within the brain the little girl representation.
Oh, transforms.
Susie. Yeah, she dissolves to the adult one while she's talking to the less character. It was like, okay, so that's basically the one time this episode that you used the brain people and the conceit of the show in a somewhat, organic and, interesting way.
Yeah, the image. So what that is the image of Herman's sister in his mind is now aligned with who she is at this moment.
Right.
So they're just going to have, that same conversation again in 10 years when she's 29 going on 30 and wants completely different things in her life. But
Or they could just stay in touch a little bit, because this is what you were talking about at the beginning. This is where she explains, what happened to Brad? He was such a great football player. And she's like, Brad played football in junior high. He tours with the Dead now. She says, you're confusing me with Marsha Brady. Right. In the 90s, we love throwing shade at the old 70s sitcoms.
Well, and we get another Herman's Head just a few episodes away from here, where Marsha Brady guest stars as the one that Herman, it's like the eye, the apple of Herman's eye.
That's true. So everything is sort of resolved between the two of them.
And he tells her that he told Jay to break up with her.
Yeah.
And she was like, you did? So he didn't want to break up with me? All right, I'm out of here. And she leaves and goes to Jay's and is like going to spend the night with him and is so excited and yay, and they're going to get together. And Herman's like, oh man. So then that's when the next day at the office, Jay comes in and he's like, oh man, like it's so great. Me and your sister, like we could, we get married and then we'll be at holidays together. And then after everybody goes to sleep, we'll go out trolling for women. Oh, maybe not. Maybe we can't do that. And Herman's like, ugh, rolling his eyes, but whatever, he's over it. And then Susie or Astrid comes in and she's all packed up, ready to go. And Jay's like, what's going on? Like, I thought this was it. I thought we were going to be a thing. And she's like, come on, Jay, you knew this was only temporary. I got to go back to school.
Yeah, a little bit of a deus ex Aniston to just have her just change her mind and decide to skip town.
Well, I think she was just trying to work some stuff out and never was really going to leave college. Like, that was never a thing that she had said. She was just having fun.
Yeah. So, yeah, this one, I mean, we get all the usual tropes, the waiting up late, where have you been, young lady, that stuff. And yeah, it's interesting how, you're right that this isn't the only one where they're friends, but how all of them have had a slightly different take on, like, there might be a complete stranger, there might be a like sort of duplicate of somebody you already know, there might be your best friend, all sort of different angles on, the various threats that come to your little sister.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, what do you think? Looking back over these, I like the coherence, I like all the overlap, and like I said, how they all kind of have their different angles, but their similarities. What are we thinking?
Man, it's like, I mean, I would have told you that Family Ties was my favorite up until this conversation, and now I'm kind of really liking Herman. I enjoyed watching all of these. The Happy Days episode was really fun in a weird way. Like, I was ready for it to be annoying and, kind of stilted and all of the misogynistic tropes to really be heightened. And none of that was true. It was just fun. Like, it didn't have that sort of reeking sexism that I was worried about. It really was like bubblegum in a way. Yeah. It was nice. Bosom Buddies, once again, this is our second go at it. It was a letdown again. So I can understand why it only had the two seasons, even though it has a pretty powerhouse cast. We got a little more Holland Taylor. I'd love to do like a Holland Taylor through the years.
Yeah.
Because she's like in so many things. Like,
I feel like we're going to get a pretty similar persona across her characters.
Yes, that's what's so interesting.
I don't see her having a ton of range.
No, that's what's so great. It's like, man, she just got a little more toxic as time went on, and then she was like super toxic.
Yeah, just a little more exhausted and smoky.
She was like super toxic by the time she got to Two and a Half Men. But yeah, I think Family Ties, Two and a Half, or Family Ties and Herman's Head. What about you?
Yeah, I don't know. To me, honestly, Herman's Head, for the reason we said, kind of bums me out. I don't like it when they don't utilize the brain people
that well. True.
I don't know. I feel like, to me, the real gem is the Happy Days because of what you were saying about the way in that first season it was filmed all over town like a movie.
Yeah.
And we got to have them sort of like on the trail, like following them from place to place, you know, trying to track down the sister and everything.
Yeah. And this definitely was not a story about Joni teaching Richie this lesson and helping him to understand.
It was
like
the least
they
fraught.
Didn't learn a lesson. They were like, "We're just going to do it better next time."
I would say that they did have the same lesson. It was just such a more gentle little tossed off. Like, we were silly to have been so protective, you know. But yeah, like
but
we
not because we're just going to do it better next time.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But I think the show still shows you by having it end with them playing Monopoly. It's showing you the audience like, weren't they dumb to be so concerned? You know, even if the characters don't really run their ways. But yeah, the sort of adventure, you know, the kind of Adventures in Babysitting quality of
that's
that.
That's true. That was fun because of that.
Yeah, that kind of makes it fun. And Family Ties is just always great because of the way that they characterize those conflicts.
Yeah.
And you get to see it played out between Alex and Mallory. It's so good. So yeah, to me, it's like those two on top. And then, like you said, Bosom Buddies is always like, it has those moments. Seeing them come out in the Bebop and Rocksteady stuff is very funny. Seeing them fall off of the cardboard fire escape and then cut to them in the crappy hospital set.
Yes.
Like, all of it is fun, but you're right. It does, at 22 minutes, it always manages to feel a little too long.
Yep.
It always feels kind of cheap. So yeah, always fun.
And it was a Miller Boyette.
Yeah, but I guess they hadn't totally gotten their groove.
I hadn't figured it out yet. No. Nope.
Yeah. All right. So much for the overprotective brothers and the adventurous little sisters. What are we talking about next week?
Next week, we are discovering your hidden talents. We're going to watch Gomer Pyle, USMC, Season 3, Episode 25, Sing a Song of Papa, Benson, Season 6, Episode 17, Solid Gold. If you're watching on Amazon, that is going to be Season 6, Episode 10. Martin, Season 4, Episode 3, Blow Baby Blow, special guest star Biggie Smalls, and Schitt's Creek, Season 4, Episode 6, Open Mic.
Yep, we are discovering secret hidden musical talents next week. We just might have our first ever guest on the Sitcom Study podcast. And until then, we will consider this segment of the Sitcom Study concluded. Thank you for listening to the Sitcom Study. Tell us what you think or share your own TV tropes and topic ideas by sending a self-addressed stamped email to sitcomstudypodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook or Instagram. And if you like the show, consider leaving a rating or review on your podcast app. It helps us boost those precious Nielsen ratings. The Sitcom Study is recorded in front of a live studio dog.